United Press International Radio Network presents 1983 in Review, a look back at those events, both good and bad, that had a profound effect on our lives during the past year. ...1983 was a year that saw more than its share of tragedy, violence, and death. At the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, Lebanon,
ambulances and fire trucks are arriving at the U.S. Embassy trying to get the dead and injured away.
At Marine headquarters in Beirut,
there was a four-story aviation safety building. I haven't seen carnage like that since Vietnam.
And in the skies over the Sea of Japan,
I think the shooting down of an unarmed civilian plane is an outrageous, despicable, cowardly, murderous act.
In 1983, American forces saw action not only in Lebanon, but on a small island in the Caribbean.
Early this morning, forces from six Caribbean democracies and the United States began a landing or landings on the island of Grenada in the eastern Caribbean.
I'm Ed Karen.
And I'm Ginny Cosola. We'll be back with 1983 in Review in just a moment.
I'm lost and lonely, scared and sad, trembling at the thought of making you mad. My love is yours, but at times you're so cold. If life's like this, take me before I grow old.
This song about child abuse was written by a man who has served time in a state prison. It tells how he felt growing up as an abused child. Many of the social problems in America today spring directly from child abuse. Yet, with enough knowledge and enough money, child abuse can be prevented. Help us get to the heart of the problem. Write Prevent Child Abuse, Box 2866, Chicago, Illinois, 60690. Message of the Ad Council and the National Committee for Prevention of Child Abuse.
1983 was a year of continued turmoil in the Middle East, with Lebanon the scene of murderous bombing attacks that took the lives of many Americans. In the Lebanon of 1983, car bombings were so frequent they became almost commonplace. But on Monday, April the 18th, an act of violence was committed that shocked and appalled even those who had come to accept violence and death as a way of life in that strife-torn nation. It was the start of a work week, and offices at the U.S. Embassy in Beirut were filled with employees. Suddenly, the sounds of typewriters and conversation were shattered by a huge explosion that reduced the building to rubble and killed 63 people, 17 of them Americans. UPI's Jack Redden arrived at the scene shortly after the blast.
Black smoke is billowing up, and the flames now cover the main floor of the building, although they probably won't spread through the concrete. French paratroopers have joined the Lebanese army in trying to clear the rubble to get at the bodies. The place is congested and it's hard for ambulances to get in to carry away the dead and injured. There's no windows left in the building and one side here is badly shattered. One wall in the back is blown open. This is Jack Redden in Beirut.
Among the Americans who died in the embassy bombing was a U.S. Marine guard. In the months to follow, other Marines would die in Lebanon, victims of sniper attacks on the Marine base at the Beirut airport. As Marine casualties mounted, some members of Congress pressed for pulling the Americans out of Lebanon before more of them died. But even the staunchest advocate of a Marine pullout could hardly have envisioned the savage and insane act that would kill and maim hundreds of Marines on a quiet morning in October. It took place at the headquarters of the 8th Marine Battalion on the edge of the Beirut airport. It was a Sunday morning, and most of the troops were still in their cots, some sleeping, others lying awake, just enjoying the luxury of not having to fall out for reveille. That peaceful scene changed in a matter of moments. Marine Major Robert Jordan describes what happened.
A large truck filled with explosives crashed through the southern gate of the BLT and drove into the lobby of the former aviation safety building, Marines call the Beirut Hilton, and detonated.
The devastation was incredible, but more incredible and tragic was the loss of life. As shaken and grief-stricken Marines carefully searched the debris for their comrades, the death toll kept rising. The final appalling total, 240 dead, more than 75 wounded. Within moments of the attack on the Marines, a similar suicide bombing took place at a building housing French soldiers, killing 58 of the paratroopers. Expressions of condolence and outrage poured in from all over the world. Again, there were calls to pull the peacekeepers out of Lebanon, but both the United States and France reaffirmed their commitment to remain.
As the year drew to a close, still more Marines died in Beirut, and U.S. warplanes hit Syrian anti-aircraft positions in Lebanon. Two American jets were shot down in that action, the first to be lost in combat since Vietnam. In Israel, 1983 was a time of crisis, a year in which Prime Minister Menachem Begin submitted his resignation and slipped into seclusion. UPI's Jeffrey Heller has more.
Close associates said Begin was depressed over the death of his wife and the drawn-out war in Lebanon. Despite a much-hailed troop withdrawal accord, Israeli soldiers stayed in Lebanon, deployed along a new line in the south, waiting for the Syrian army to pull out. Meanwhile, Israeli soldiers continue to die in roadside explosions and the suicide bombings. On the bright side, relations with Washington improved, partly due to the Marine headquarters bombing. That tragedy gave Israel and the United States a common adversary, Syria, and President Reagan and Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir agreed on closer strategic cooperation. Jeffrey Heller, Tel Aviv.
Just 2 days after the suicidal attack on U.S. Marines in Beirut, American servicemen found themselves involved in a military action not in the turbulent Middle East, but on the small Caribbean island of Grenada. The first word that a military operation was underway came over Radio Free Grenada, which interspersed programs of reggae music with frantic announcements that the island was being invaded.
United States paratroopers have invaded Grenada with helicopter gunships. Our armed forces are engaging them in fierce battle. All Grenadians report immediately to our respective militia bases. All doctors, nurses, and medics report to the hospital immediately. The Grenadian people are asked to block all roads and obstruct the enemy's progress. United States paratroopers have invaded Grenada with helicopter gunships.
Operating man, hear what I say, if you can.
Grenada had been a source of concern to the Reagan administration for some time. Under the leadership of Prime Minister Maurice Bishop, who came to power in a coup in 1979, the island's government had made a decided turn to the left. Just 8 months after taking over, Bishop announced that Cuba would help Grenada build a new airport with a 10,000-foot runway. He said it would be able to accommodate large jetliners and thus bolster the island's tourist business. What he did not say, but what was quite apparent, was that the airport would also be able to handle long-range military aircraft. Shortly after he took office, President Reagan told Bishop that his ties with Cuba posed a threat to peace in the area. If President Reagan felt Maurice Bishop was leaning too far to the left, Bishop's deputy Prime Minister Bernard Cord apparently felt Bishop was too much of a moderate. His solution to this problem was to seize control of the government and place Bishop under house arrest. What he hadn't counted on was Bishop's popularity. Several thousand of his supporters staged a demonstration and freed the Prime Minister. Bishop led his followers to the Grenadian Army headquarters at Fort Rupert, where fighting broke out and as many as 40 people were killed, including Bishop and several of his top officials. When the shooting was over, Grenada had its third leader in a matter of days. He was Army General Hudson Austin, who announced he was the head of a new 16-member Revolutionary Military Council. Washington monitored events in Grenada with growing alarm. One concern was the safety of about 1,000 Americans on the island, most of them students at the St. George's Medical School. Soon there were rumors that a military operation was about to begin, or had already begun. Finally, on the morning of Tuesday, October the 25th, President Reagan made the official announcement.
Early this morning, forces from six Caribbean democracies and the United States began a landing or landings on the island of Grenada in the Eastern Caribbean. We have taken this decisive action for three reasons. First, and to overriding importance, to protect innocent lives, including up to 1,000 Americans whose personal safety is, of course, my paramount concern.
There was widespread opposition in the United Nations and among our allies to the U.S. action. But while the leaders of other nations bridled at the thought of American forces being in Grenada, there was overwhelming support for the Americans on the island itself.
Grenadians are free. We are thankful to the President of the United States for what he has done for Grenada. At last, we are free.
Praise God and thanks to Mr. Reagan that we are delivered and we're once again so happy.
On the Saturday following the invasion, Deputy Prime Minister Bernard Cord was captured by U.S. Marines. In the days following, General Hudson Austin was also captured. Cubans were sent back to Havana. Soviet diplomats were ordered to leave the island. An interim government was formed and American troops began their withdrawal.
1983 was an especially tragic year for the people of South Korea. First, there was the downing of a commercial airliner. UPI's Tom Foti recalls the details of that shocking incident.
When South Korean Airline Flight 7 from New York to Seoul took off from Anchorage following a refueling stop there, it seemed like a routine event. Flight 7, of course, never reached its destination, and in the days and weeks that followed, U.S.-Soviet relations took a drastic turn for the worse. In the early morning hours of that day, Flight 7 disappeared from radar screens in the North Pacific. It strayed into Soviet territory, apparently flew out, then strayed back in with a Soviet jet fighter on its tail. Secretary of State Shultz detailed what happened next.
The Soviet pilot reported that he fired a missile, and the target was destroyed.
269 people died when Flight 7 was blown out of the sky, among them more than 60 Americans, including Georgia Congressman Larry McDonald. It took the Soviets several days to admit that they destroyed the plane, and then they blamed the incident on the United States, saying the Jumbo 747 jet was on a spy mission. Anger in the U.S. was strong from President Reagan on down, but the Soviets insisted that if their territory were violated again, they'd react the same way. Tom Foti, Washington.
While still reeling from the shock of the airliner disaster, South Koreans were hit with still another tragedy. This one in the form of a bombing attack against South Korean officials visiting Rangoon, Burma. The scene was a national cemetery where South Korean President Chun Doo-hwan was to have taken part in a wreath-laying ceremony. But Chun was delayed in heavy traffic and was running a few minutes late. This may have saved his life. Other high-ranking South Korean officials were already at the Martyrs' Mausoleum awaiting the president's arrival. Suddenly, an ear-splitting explosion tore through the building, transforming it into a smoking ruin. The blast, which was apparently intended for President Chun, killed 17 South Koreans, including many top members of the government. South Korean officials blamed North Korea for the bombing, and when President Reagan visited South Korea, he too said North Korea was responsible. ...1983 in review will continue in just a moment.
Hey, that was some party. Every time I turned around, somebody filled my glass.
Bill, you all right? I don't think you should drive.
No, come on. I'm perfectly fine. I'll get in and let's go. Yep, I'm feeling terrific. Now, let's see. Where are those keys? Here they are. Knew I had them somewhere.
That last drink you had was enough to fill a
nightcap, that's all. Okay, here we go. Want to hit that little place down the road?
I think you ought to hit the sack.
I'm absolutely fine. What are you doing? Hey, give me back my keys. Why you do that?
You'll get them after I drive you home.
You're some friend. Won't even let me drive my own car.
He is a good friend, Bill. Fact is, friends don't let friends drive drunk. This has been a public service message from the Licensed Beverage Information Council in cooperation with the U.S. Department of Transportation.
Congressional lawmakers faced difficult decisions in 1983. Correspondent Pi Chamberlain reviews the year in Congress.
Congress propped up Social Security, put restrictions on the president's power to command troops, and honored Martin Luther King Jr. with a federal holiday. More important to many was Congress's failure to reduce the $200 billion budget deficits forecast for the foreseeable future. Other plans that failed? Domestic content, a bill to make foreign automakers make more parts in America. Deregulation of natural gas prices, the nuclear weapons freeze, and immigration reform. The best thing Congress did, and one of the toughest, was to pass new taxes and benefit growth cuts to keep Social Security solvent. Without it, checks would have been delayed and possibly cut. Ways and Means Chairman Dan Rostenkowski of Illinois took to the House floor with pride.
It is a cautious, fair plan that raises enough revenue to ease the system through the decade, and also closes the enormous deficits built up in the next century.
Congress took two big steps on civil rights. It declared the third Monday in January, starting in 1986, to be a federal holiday honoring Martin Luther King Jr. After President Reagan said he would fire three liberal civil rights commissioners, Congress took away half his power to hire and fire and denied him the power to appoint a commission majority. With regard to the Marines in Lebanon, Congress invoked the 10-year-old War Powers Law for the first time. This action, which the president signed, asserted for the first time that the president would have to withdraw troops within 90 days without explicit permission from Congress. At the same time, Congress granted that permission for 18 months. Pye Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
In another piece of major legislation, Congress voted to begin production of the controversial MX missile.
This action came as good news to President Reagan, whose third year in office was dominated not only by domestic problems, but by a series of international crises. Early in the year, he went to the country with a plea for support for a Central American policy.
A faraway totalitarian power has set its sights on our friends and neighbors in Central America and the Caribbean. If we don't meet our responsibilities there, we'll pay dearly for it.
In the months following, Mr. Reagan was faced with the Beirut bombings, the invasion of Grenada, and the shooting down of the South Korean airliner. This put an even greater strain on U.S.-Soviet relations. Ironically, the somber global developments occurred against a background of dramatically improving U.S. economy. The public apparently liked Mr. Reagan's leadership, and at year's end, his job approval rate stood at 62%. 1983 was not without its embarrassing moments for the president. One of these was triggered by one of Mr. Reagan's most controversial cabinet members. James Watt, then Interior Secretary, was addressing a Chamber of Commerce meeting about minority representation on a panel commissioned to study his coal leasing practices.
Five members, three Democrats, two Republicans, every kind of mix you can have. I have a black, I have a woman, two Jews and a cripple.
That comment led to Watt's resignation and a reshuffling of cabinet posts.
1983 was also a year that saw a great deal of action in the political arena. Correspondent Bill Small reviews the highlights.
1983 was the year that Chicago and Philadelphia both elected the first black mayors in their histories. Harold Washington in Chicago, Wilson Good in Philadelphia. At the presidential level, it was the year of the first black male presidential candidate. The shouts of "Run, Jesse, run!" finally convinced the Reverend Jackson to make it official.
I rise to declare my decision to seek the nomination of the Democratic Party for the presidency of the United States of America.
Jesse Jackson isn't alone. The year ended with seven other Democratic hopefuls. Senators Alan Cranston, Gary Hart, John Glenn, and Ernest Hollings had announced, along with former Vice President Walter Mondale, former Florida Governor Reuben Askew, and former Senator and presidential candidate George McGovern. But if the Democrat stable was full, the Republican lineup was empty, at least officially. But Ronald Reagan had authorized formation of a campaign committee, making him a legal, if not formally announced, candidate. And at year's end, Mr. Reagan's counselor, Edwin Meese, said he sees no chance that the president will not seek re-election.
I have not seen any indication whatsoever that the president, when he makes his ultimate decision and announcement, will not indicate that he's going to run again.
And by year's end, the White House was saying that Mr. Reagan plans to announce his intentions in a televised speech on January 29th. Bill Small, Washington.
1983 saw the lifting of martial law in Poland and the awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize to Lech Wałęsa, leader of the outlawed Solidarity labor movement. It was also the year Pope John Paul II made an historic visit to his native land and was welcomed by millions of cheering Poles. Poland was not the only country visited by the Pope during the past year. He also traveled to Lourdes, France, to Austria, and against the advice of many, to Central America. Because of the potentially dangerous situation in El Salvador and Nicaragua, there was concern for his safety. But Pope John Paul delivered his message of peace and completed his eight-nation journey without mishap. The Pope's visit to Central America brought hope and comfort to millions, but failed to end the strife in that part of the world. Michael Drudge reports from San Salvador.
In El Salvador, there remains no end in sight to the four-year-old civil war. As Christmas neared, leftist guerrillas had regained momentum after a year in which the demoralized army dumped a defense minister, launched a new offensive, and then lost its punch in an apparent leadership crisis that sparked rumors of a coup. Right-wing death squads took advantage of the turmoil, prompting a stern warning from the United States that aid could be cut. This is Michael Drudge in San Salvador.
In 1983, an event took place in the Philippines that plunged that country into turmoil. On August 21st, a 50-year-old politician named Benigno Aquino was gunned down and killed at the Manila International Airport. Aquino, who had opposed the regime of President Ferdinand Marcos for all 17 years of its existence, was shot within minutes of his return to his native country after 3 years of self-imposed exile. Marcos expressed shock at the murder and said his government had no involvement in it. Millions of Filipinos apparently felt otherwise and staged massive demonstrations calling for Marcos' resignation. There were demonstrations of a quite different kind in other parts of the world. Concern over the threat of a nuclear war prompted worldwide anti-nuclear protests. Jim Kolesar reports some of the biggest were held in major cities across Western Europe and at U.S. military bases in West Germany and Great Britain.
The focus of this new protest was the stationing in Western Europe of new U.S. nuclear missiles. NATO had decided to deploy the Cruise and Pershing II missiles unless an agreement was reached at the Geneva arms talks. As the year progressed, it became clear that no agreement was likely before the deployment date. The Soviets threatened to walk out of the talks if any of the missiles arrived. Cruise missiles were scheduled to touch down first at Greenham Common Air Base west of London. For more than 2 years, women protesters had camped out there to try to prevent the Cruise deployment. But they could only stand and watch when U.S. Air Force jets landed with the missiles on board. The women claimed they were not disappointed.
Certainly not.
No.
They got them in by air because we're here, and that's the only way they're going to get them out.
That night, one of them led a candlelight protest.
Candles are always a symbol of peace and of hope, too, because we haven't given up. This is just the beginning of the next stage in our campaign against nuclear weapons, and those candles stand for the hope we have that, in fact, they will be dismantled and they will be taken away.
In Geneva, the Soviets made good on their threat. They walked out and vowed to deploy new missiles themselves in Eastern Europe and other missiles aboard submarines that they said would threaten U.S. territory. Jim Kolesar, London.
You're listening to 1983 in Review. We'll be back with more of the year's top stories in just a moment.
And upon your retirement, we present you Harold Dunkley with this fine gold watch.
Hey, nice ceremony, Harold. Congratulations.
Thanks, Sam.
You lucky dog. I'll bet the first thing you're going to do is dip into that IRA and buy yourself a new set of golf clubs.
IRA?
And I imagine you and the missus are all set for that trip of your dreams.
Trip?
And knowing what a shrewd businessman you are, you've probably got your whole budget drawn up for living on your retirement pay.
Budget?
Boy, Harold, I wish I were in your shoes.
Sam.
What, pal?
Do you think J.B. would trade me a job for a gold watch?
Retirement planning is something to consider many years before you have that gold watch in hand. The National Association of Mature People wants to help you make your mature years your best years. If you're over 40, send for a free pamphlet called Retirement Planning Tips from NAMP, Box 54,000, Oklahoma City, 73154.
The economy was on the minds of many Americans during 1983. The year began with the recession still more than just a memory. But by spring, the economic skies began to clear. And as Dennis Galino recalls, analysts wondered why they ever worried about high interest rates.
The American consumer rediscovered that old enthusiasm. Factories had to start hiring. Builders could hardly put up new houses fast enough. And by the time the year was over, the unemployment rate surprised almost everyone by its rapid improvement. While tax cuts helped put money in cash registers, economists outside the administration gave their anti-inflation awards to Paul Volcker. The Federal Reserve Board chairman, safely confirmed to a new term, kept preaching austerity, but $200 billion federal deficits remained, helping keep interest rates high and the dollar expensive enough overseas to produce the worst American trade performance ever. The president's top economist, Martin Feldstein, urged Congress to balance the budget, even if that meant raising taxes. But taxes were not what the president had in mind, and the resulting flap forced Feldstein to fight for his job.
I support the president's program, and I believe that his fiscal policies in the past 3 years are an outstanding record of achievement.
Most bank accounts were completely deregulated, giving lots more savers the kind of interest payments only rich people used to get. The stock market broke through to record highs, and the one stock held by the most people, AT&T, was poised to start the new year split into eight pieces, the result of the most sweeping piece of government intervention corporate America had ever seen. This is Dennis Galino at the Treasury Department.
Although the nation's unemployment picture improved during the past year, there were at year's end more than 9.5 million Americans still out of work. But even for some of the working force, there were problems. Ken Robbins reports.
The word give back became prevalent during labor negotiations, and most unions fought hard to preserve gains they had made in earlier contracts. Bargaining talks didn't always work, and there were strikes. Greyhound was crippled when its drivers walked out after refusing to take pay cuts. Continental Airlines was struck after the company declared bankruptcy, and teachers' disputes kept students away from classrooms in a number of cities. There were also some significant agreements. When Chrysler Corporation was able to pay back government loans that kept the company in business, employees shared the wealth when negotiations were begun and an agreement was worked out. Eastern Airlines managed to avoid following Continental into bankruptcy and persuaded its employees to agree to a new contract. There were some givebacks, but jobs were saved. This is Ken Robbins.
For America's space program, 1983 was a year of achievement, a year which saw the nation's first woman astronaut launched into space. Correspondent Rob Navius was at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida on that historic occasion.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. We go for main engine start. We have main engine start and the ignition. And liftoff of STS-7 and America's first woman astronaut. And the shuttle has cleared the tower.
The launch in June of Sally Ride as America's first spacewoman came 20 years after the Soviets first placed a woman into orbit and was the unqualified highlight of an exciting but difficult year for the nation's space agency. Problems with main engines on America's second space shuttle orbiter Challenger delayed its maiden launch from January until April, and booster rocket troubles left Challenger's first payload, a large tracking satellite, in a faulty orbit, causing the rest of the year's launches to be rescheduled. In August, America's first black astronaut, Guy Bluford, went aloft on a flight that began with the first night launch and ended with the first night landing at Edwards Air Force Base. And in October, NASA celebrated its 25th anniversary, a celebration NASA Administrator James Beggs said was richly deserved.
It puts a bit of a halo around everything else we do in the area of stretching ourselves further in not only in high technology, but in everything else we do.
The year ended with a joint mission between NASA and the European Space Agency on the shuttle Columbia, using the Science Workshop Space Lab to conduct dozens of complex experiments by six astronauts and scientists. Rob Nabius, Washington.
Extreme weather conditions affected the United States in 1983. Much of the country baked under record or near-record temperatures as back-to-back heat waves struck in the summer months. At least 200 people died of heat-related causes. In the South, floodwaters drove thousands from their homes from Mississippi to Alabama to the Louisiana Delta. Property damage was counted in the billions of dollars. Hurricane Alicia roared into the Texas coast, killing 18 people and causing an estimated $1 billion in damage. And in Coalinga, California, an earthquake almost leveled the town. Miraculously, there were no fatalities.
During the early part of 1983, worldwide attention was focused on the University of Utah Medical Center in Salt Lake City, where a 62-year-old dentist waged a gallant fight to stay alive. Barney Clark, the world's first recipient of an artificial heart, was described by one doctor as a rugged old Rocky Mountain sagebrush, tough and eager for life. His courage won him the admiration and affection of people all over the world, but after a struggle that lasted 112 days, Barney Clark died.
The nation also mourned the passing of actors Pat O'Brien, David Niven, Raymond Massey, Lynn Fontanne, Gloria Swanson, and Joan Hackett. Entertainers Arthur Godfrey and Mary Livingston. Musicians Arthur Rubinstein, Harry James, and U.B. Blake. Lyricist Ira Gershwin and playwright Tennessee Williams died during the year. The religious world said goodbye to Cardinals Terence Cook of New York and Humberto Medeiros of Boston. Politics lost Senator Henry Jackson and Representative Clement Zablocki. Others who passed away during 1983 include television newscasters Frank Reynolds and Jessica Savage. 1983 was not without its lighter, happier stories. One of these concerned a spectacular celebration to mark the 100th anniversary of the building of the Brooklyn Bridge. It was a terrific party. About 2 million people were on hand, among them correspondent Carol Brooks.
It was one of the biggest parties the city has ever seen, and as New York City Mayor Ed Koch put it,
it is an event that can never happen again.
And some of the spectators put it this way.
This is one of the most exciting evenings I've had in New York.
I love it.
This is great.
A wonderful time.
There was a street fair featuring dancers and music, and a parade of hovercraft sounded horns as they sailed up the East River. But the most spectacular event was the huge fireworks display that lit up the sky as the night drew to a close. And all of this was to say,
happy birthday, Brooklyn Bridge.
Carol Brooks, New York.
The year also saw the selection of the first black Miss America. Vanessa Williams, who represented New York State in the pageant, hopes the exposure will help her launch a career on Broadway. That famous thoroughfare said goodbye in 1983 to the musical show Annie, which closed after more than 2,300 performances and almost 6 years on Broadway.
And so the year is finished, and those events that shaped and changed the lives of so many are now part of history.
You've been listening to 1983 in Review. The program was written by Ed Cairns, produced by Ed Cairns and Ken Robbins. 1983 in Review is a production of the UPI Radio Network.
United States paratroopers have invaded Grenada with helicopter gunships.
That frantic announcement over Radio Free Grenada was part of one of the major stories of 1983. This is Ed Cairns inviting you to join Jenny Cosola and me as we look back on the stories and the people that shaped events during the past year. Listen for 1983 in Review here on this station.